Heard this morning, first up, is case number 74966, Prevent Sanctuary Cities et al. If the parties are ready to proceed, do so. This is scheduled for a one-hour argument.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. My name is Paul Jordan. I represent appellants in this matter, Prevent Sanctuary Cities, Pat and Jeremy Hughes. I would like to reserve 10 minutes of rebuttal. I do recognize that we did not file a reply, so technically pursuant to NRAP 34, I'm not entitled to it mandatorily, but I would request permission from the Court to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
So you didn't, as you've indicated, so you're obligated to use up your time in your opening remarks.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justices, the issue in this case is whether the Prevent Sanctuary Cities initiative satisfies the constitutional requirements and the statutory requirements to be able to proceed to gather signatures to potentially be placed on the ballot in the upcoming election. We submit that the initiative petition does satisfy those requirements, specifically with regard to the statute NRS 295.009, because it embraces only a single subject, because all of the parts of the initiative petition are functionally related and germane to that single subject, and because the description of effect is succinct, non-argumentative, direct, not misleading, not deceptive, and identifies what the initiative petition proposes to do and how it will accomplish that goal.
Let me ask you that one right off the bat. What does it propose to do other than what's stated right there? I mean, how would the average voter know just exactly what the impact is? Explain that to us and to me in
particular. Your Honor, I would respond that it doesn't do anything other than what's stated in the initiative petition. That the initiative petition, the purpose of the initiative petition is to prevent cities, counties, and the state government from passing or enforcing laws, statutes, or ordinances that discourage the cooperation of the enforcement of the immigration laws of the United States. That is what the petition does. It does what it says, and it says what it does.
What does that mean, though?
What would the average voter think that meant? What's the effect on individuals?
The effect on individuals, I would submit, is not the issue, frankly, before the Court. But nonetheless, the effect, the direct actual consequence of the passage of this initiative petition is to limit the ability of the state, the cities, and counties from passing certain laws that discourage the enforcement of the immigration laws. Now, the opponents of this provision have identified a number, I would say a litany, of hypothetical potential consequences that might possibly occur if the initiative is passed, and then if a city or state were to be prohibited from enacting any such law, policy, or ordinance. But from a standpoint of what are the material, direct, actual consequences of the passage of this initiative, the material, actual, direct consequences of the passage of this initiative are to prevent those cities, counties, and the state from passing any such laws. All of the other potential consequences that are identified by the opponents, and which frankly the district court didn't get into at all in its analysis, are hypothetical and speculative.
And I'm looking at it in the sense of this being overbroad.
Your Honor, I would submit respectfully that the overbreadth analysis is a substantive challenge to the initiative petition. The district court didn't call it as such. The district court effectively, as I see it, created a new rule that applies to initiative petitions. The initiative, the rule as it stands are, is it a single subject or not? Does it satisfy the requirements of NRS 295.009 with respect to, is it a single subject, and then are all parts functionally related and germane to that single subject? The district court in this case, and I understand it's a de novo review, so to some extent that doesn't matter, but the district court in this case did not follow the test, the single subject test, but I would submit created a new test under the law. He created a new test that is a broad subject test.
Well, I'm going back to the description of effect.
And what was your question, Your Honor?
The description of effect being broad.
the description of effect is no broader than the actual petition initiative itself. So if we turn to, I was going to start with a single subject, but I'll turn to description of effect.
Right.
In the cases where this court has found a violation of the description of effect, such as the RAP Commerce Tax case, the No Solar Tax, the Las Vegas taxpayers case, the court has found that there are actual, direct, indisputed consequences of the passage of the initiative. Las Vegas taxpayers, it was to undo the existing law for the redevelopment plan for Clark County. No Solar Tax, it was to take away the PUC's ability to regulate rates. RAP Commerce, it was to make it so the budget would not be balanced. This court found that those were direct, actual consequences that were uncontroverted, that the description of effect didn't discuss those consequences, and therefore it was misleading. Here, there are no such consequences, Your Honor, and I would refer the court, for instance, to the fiscal note prepared by the LCB's Division of Fiscal Analysis. This is at page 95 of the Joint Appendix. The LCB analyzed this proposed initiative petition to determine whether it had a fiscal impact on any of the jurisdictions. And I understand that that was restricted to fiscal. It wasn't restricted to all practical matters. But the LCB, in analyzing it, reached out to the public agencies who would be affected, to potentially affected by the initiative, and determined that no government entities in the state of Nevada have enacted a law or ordinance or otherwise formally adopted, enforced, or endorsed a policy that would prohibit, limit, or discourage cooperation with the enforcement of federal immigration laws. So what it found there is there's no...
Excuse me.
Yes,
you just said you were talking about physical impact. What you just read was not physical impact.
I was going to read the following sentence.
You didn't. You were going off on another direction, and I'm concerned because as we got into that, the first thing that comes in mind is cost of keeping individuals in jail on holds when they've not offended any of our local state or county or city ordinances. Is there a note, a physical note, as to what it's costing to hold people in jail during that time if, in fact, they're held in jail?
There is not, Your Honor. Let me,
let me ask you a question more specifically, though. In the order from the district court, it indicates that the petition here violates NRS 295-009 single subject requirement because it is excessively broad and general and, in fact, embraces a multitude of subjects. As a result, the petition is misleading and confusing to voters. Additionally, it goes on in that same paragraph. It ends with, the petition is further confusing and misleading to voters because the title states, prevent sanctuary cities. But the text is much broader and affects many different aspects of state, county, and city functioning beyond the commonly misunderstood concept of so-called sanctuary cities. How do you respond to that language in the district court's order?
Well, I think, Your Honor, first and foremost, the district court, with all due respect, will not follow the applicable test and that pursuant to NRS 295-09 and has been developed by this court in analyzing 295.09 is a two-step process. The first step is to determine what the purpose or subject of the initiative petition is. The second step is once there's been a determination of whether that's a single subject or multiple subjects, to then determine pursuant to subsection 2 of 295.09 whether all parts of the petition are functionally related and germane to each other and our purpose.
Very specifically, and Justice Perry asked you earlier, as to what the district court embraces as excessively broad and general. How do you respond to that?
I respond that that's a misinterpretation of this court's prior jurisprudence from primarily the Las Vegas taxpayer case that discussed excessively broad and general, and here's why. In the Las Vegas taxpayers case, the district court and this court found that there were actually two subjects to that petition. One subject was public-private lease purchase agreements, and one subject was the redevelopment plan. The proponents of that petition then argued, no, this all falls under the general umbrella of voter approval. And so the subject is voter approval, It's not these two separate subjects. This court held, following some California cases and other law, that you cannot take, when you have two separate subjects, you cannot combine them under a single umbrella of an excessively broad term to survive the single subject rule. So that did not say that initiative petitions cannot be brought. There is no requirement under Article 19 of the Constitution. There is no requirement under NRS 295.009 that you can't have broad subjects so long as it's a single subject. And where the district court erred in this case, that the district court did not analyze whether this was a single subject pursuant to the statute and this court's jurisprudence. The district court did not analyze whether all parts of the initiative petition were functionally related and germane to each other and that single subject. Instead, the court picked up on the term excessively broad, and I would submit created a new legal standard. In addition to the single subject test, if you adopt the district court's findings, we now have a single subject test and we have a broad subject test, which is a different issue. There's two problems with that. The first problem is that is inconsistent with the Constitution, the statute, and this court's ruling to create a new broad subject test. The second problem with that is that comes down to a substantive challenge of the language of the petition. As the court is aware, the only basis for review at this time is the satisfaction, pursuant to the satisfaction of 295.009. Substantive challenges have to wait until there's a determination of whether the petition has passed the voters and been enacted upon.
Counsel, as you've skimmed over that area, cannot the court inquire as to what, in fact, is that single subject? The court, again, in its decision, talks about immigration laws, removal, prior convictions of crime, student visa, international law, asylum law, and a number of other things that are within the broad nature of the terminology that's been used. And that terminology that's been used, and again, referring back to Justice Perry's questioning, are not so specific that they identify exactly what we are talking about under this broad brush of Prevent Sanctuary Cities initiative.
I think certainly the language of the petition references the immigration laws of the United States. Certainly the immigration laws of the United States are a broad subject and encompasses different aspects. However, I would respectfully submit that that is still a single subject, and that analyzing that initiative petition pursuant to the statute and this court's jurisprudence leads to the conclusion that even though it's a broad subject, it is a single subject. Have I answered your question?
I didn't comment, counsel. You're free to go forward.
Thank you, Your Honor. So with respect to the proper analysis of the single subject rule, as we've discussed, the first step is to determine what the purpose or subject of the initiative petition is. For this initiative petition, it's clear, and it's been consistently argued, and it's clear from the language of the petition itself, that the purpose or object of the petition initiative is to prevent cities, counties, and the state government from passing laws, ordinances, or policies that prohibit, limit, or discourage cooperation with the enforcement of the immigration laws of the United States. I don't think there's been any argument that there's an other purpose or other subject to this initiative petition. It's interesting to note that in the district court's decision, the district court, although it identified what the arguments of the parties were as to the purpose, the district court never made a finding as to what the purpose or subject of the petition was. The second step, once you've determined what the purpose or subject of the petition is, to determine pursuant to subsection 2 of NRS 295.009, are all of the parts of the initiative petition functionally related and germane to each other? The court has expanded on that test in Las Vegas Taxpayers and other cases to talk about, are they functionally related and germane both to each other and to the purpose? And I would submit, in reviewing this petition, I don't think it can be argued that there's anything in this three-sentence long petition, which is basically just a repetition of the same sentence except one sentence applies to cities, one sentence applies to counties, and one sentence applies to the state, that is not functionally related and germane to every other part of this initiative petition. The analysis is quite simple and straightforward. In a review of the language of the petition itself, on the face of the petition, and it clearly establishes that every single portion of this initiative petition is functionally related and germane to every other portion of the initiative petition, and is also functionally related and germane to the purpose of the initiative petition. So, therefore, I would submit that it is a plain reading of the petition, constitutional requirements, the statutory requirements, and the jurisprudence of this court. It's clear that this petition satisfies the single subject rule. And we talked about the reasons why the district court was wrong. The district court didn't apply that rule. The district court, in my mind, created a new rule and ignored the single subject rule and created a new rule, which is, I would think, would be called the broad subject rule. And the district court, in applying an overbreadth analysis, is really a constitutional 14th Amendment type due process type of challenge, which is premature for that court's review and, frankly, this court's review at this time. So I believe that the record clearly establishes that this petition satisfies a single subject rule.
Mr. Georgeson, moving to a separate subject, one that began with Justice Perrigari's question, I'd like to focus on the description of effect. The district court didn't analyze much about the description of effect in this case because the district court said essentially the description of effect did not describe any effects of the proposed constitutional amendment. It does seem, from a pragmatic standpoint, that prohibiting state and local governments from enacting laws that affect the enforcement of immigration would have some effects. Justice Douglas mentioned potential fiscal impacts associated with individuals on ICE hold who are not otherwise under arrest. There's asylum issues there. The subject matter of immigration is rather broad. So what you're telling me is that this description of effect, I'd like to hear your viewpoint about the district court's observation that it essentially didn't describe any effect. It just appears to have restated what the initiative stands for. And then secondly, to the extent that the description of effect is considered ineffectual, should this court remand the case to the district court to assess what the proper description of effect should be?
With respect to the sufficiency of the description of effect, I was reading off the, for instance, the LCB's fiscal analysis division. And the next sentence that I was going to read after the LCB determined that there are no such laws in existence at this time was, quote, thus, the enactment of the initiative would have no effect upon state or local government based on this present status. The district court, in analyzing the description of effect, has not identified what effects are supposed to be in there that it believes were missing. With respect to the effects that the opponents have raised, such as increased costs, or the evidence in the record, are there no increased costs, such as effects on education, such as effects on safety, I would respectfully submit that all of those are speculative, hypothetical effects. There are no effects that they have identified that I would consider a direct, actual consequence of the passage of this. We have to consider that the actual effect of this statute, this initiative petition, is to prevent governments from taking certain actions. Might there be ultimate downstream effects at the second level as a result of that? Yes, there might be. They might be the effects that the opponents have talked about, but the opponents have not identified any actual, direct, undisputed effects that would be required to be placed in the description of effect, which is, the court is aware, has to be 200 words or less. It has to be straightforward, which this is clearly straightforward. It has to be succinct. The argument here is it's too succinct, possibly. It has to be non-argumentative. There's no argument here that this...
Well, actually, no, Mr. Georgeson. It would seem from your argument, the proponents are saying that if you enact this initiative petition, there will be no effects resulting from the enactment. Why doesn't your description of effects say that?
Let's back up.
Yes. What is the test we've enacted to evaluate descriptions of effect in initiative petitions?
Test is it straightforward, succinct, and non-argumentative? Is it deceptive or misleading? Does it describe what it is intended to achieve? And does it describe how it intends to reach that goal? So if I may walk through those, I'd be happy to. So is it straightforward? Yes, it's straightforward. It simply recites essentially the language of the initiative petition, which I understand is their objection, but it is clearly straightforward. Is it succinct? Absolutely, it's succinct. I think I counted it's less than 80 words, even though we had 200. Is it non-argumentative? It is non-argumentative. It doesn't have the language that's been stricken in other cases, such as reasonableness and fairness and safety and welfare. If those types of issues were included, it would be argued that it was argumentative. Is it deceptive or misleading? It's not deceptive. It doesn't deceive the public as to what the effect of this is. Their argument is it's misleading because it doesn't include a hypothetical effect. But I would submit it's not misleading. For instance, I can't remember which case it was, the court expanded on deceptive and misleading and talked about, is it a correct statement of the initiative? It is clearly a correct statement of the initiative. Does it misrepresent anything that's in the initiative? It does not misrepresent anything in the initiative. So then it comes down to, does it describe what it is intended to achieve? It's because this petition is so simple and straightforward, describing what it is intended to achieve is simple and straightforward. Is it intended to prohibit these governments from taking these actions? That's what it is intended to achieve. How is it going to achieve this? Again, it's a straightforward answer. It's going to achieve this by adding a provision, an amendment to the Constitution to prohibit these agencies from doing so. So the attacks on the description of
the effect is prohibitory on local government, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Not unlike the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech.
Yes, Your Honor.
And of the press. I mean, it's a prohibition, so its effect is directly on legislature and county and local government.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And that's exactly what the description of effect says. It says that if enacted, this measure will add a new section to the Nevada Constitution that will prohibit the legislature, a county, or a city from enacting a law or ordinance or otherwise adopting. I don't need to keep repeating, but that's exactly what it does, and that's exactly what the description of effect says.
Counsel, could you humor me for just a second? Just exactly what laws were the proponents anticipating were going to be enacted that caused this initiative to be generated? Prepared.
Your Honor, I could only speculate. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion.
Why is it necessary?
Why is it necessary is because there have been jurisdictions throughout the country who have decided to refuse and fail to cooperate with the U.S. government in the enforcement of its immigration laws, and that's what this is intended to prevent.
And why would they refuse to cooperate?
For political reasons, Your Honor.
For instance, what? Reasons.
California. Some of them are budgetary, some of them are political with respect to their perceptions as to undocumented immigrants and their rights.
Isn't that a true effect? Something that ought to be explained?
I think, Your Honor, based on... So there's a couple of issues there, Your Honor. First of all, again, it doesn't have to be the best statement. It has to be a correct, accurate, succinct, non-argumentative statement.
I agree.
At what point, and I asked the question, I know Justice Hardesty asked this question in one of the other cases, where does it end? If you start listing these hypothetical potential effects, where does it end? How do you decide where to draw the line? And then how do the petition drafters, not just in this case, but in other cases, how do they decide and anticipate what effects the opponents are going to argue are the result of this petition? Are they hypothetical? How hypothetical are they? Are they direct? How indirect are they? And which ones have to be included? So I think the problem is, Your Honor, is there may be, there are hypothetical speculative effects that may occur down the line as a result of the political process if this initiative petition is passed.
There's a legal question that your opponents are arguing that because the statute speaks of the petition and then the description of effect, that the description of effect cannot statutorily just say the same thing as the petition. Could you comment on that?
Your Honor, it can if it is an accurate, succinct, direct, non-argumentative, non-misleading, non-deceptive description that satisfies the requirements of the statute. I mean, there are certainly cases. The education petition was 25 pages long. And that has to be summarized within 200 words. There are other ones that are shorter. Maybe there's one that I'm familiar with that may be shorter than this. But the requirement is exactly what we talked about, straightforward, succinct, non-argumentative, not deceptive, not misleading. This description of effect is none of those things, I would submit. This description, and the court's jurisprudence on this issue describes and discusses at length what where the line is between hypothetical effects and hypothetical potential effects and other effects. And we talked about, I mentioned the Las Vegas taxpayers case, the RIP tax. Those are cases where this court has found a concrete, direct, actual consequence that would occur as a result of the passage of the initiative and has made a determination that that concrete, direct, actual consequence was not identified in the description of effect and therefore has found that the description of effect is invalid. I turn back to the court's order, which Justice Hardesty indicated. The court has not made a determination, the district court did not make a determination or identify any potential effects that are not included in this petition description that should be included. The parties, the opponents.
Well, no, the district court said, I find the description of effect ineffectual because it doesn't describe any effects at all. It doesn't say there'll be no effects. Nor does it say there will be effects.
I mean, to misspeak to indicate that.
No, I'm not criticizing your argument. I'm just making the point that the district court's ruling on this subject was fairly simple. The description of effect is defective because it fails to describe any effects. The proponents in this case, even if this is viewed as a prohibitory provision, like, for example, the First Amendment, it would still seem, under the requirement of the statute, that the proponent should say, adopting this provision creates no effects. That I'm not sure that one can say that
truthfully. But that would not be accurate either, because you would not have the prohibition.
Right.
I do respectfully disagree with the statement that if there are no effects, you have to say there are no effects. I think if there are no effects, you don't have to identify the effect. I don't think you have to go to the next step and say there are no effects. One of the things I would point out on the issue of what are the effects, I would turn back to the briefing below, where the plaintiffs, the opponents, listed this litany of potential consequences. And in their brief, in the Joint Appendix 80, they say, plaintiffs do not contend that every one of the effects described in plaintiff's memorandum must be included in the petitioner's description of effects. The described effects, however, are clear examples of effects that could have been included but were completely ignored. This comes back to the question of how do the petition drafters determine, if the opponents can't even determine what effects have to be included because they're the important actual ones, how are the petition drafters supposed to anticipate what those have to be included and what have to be identified? And back to the, where do you ever end? How does somebody successfully draft a petition to meet the requirements if they have to anticipate which speculative hypothetical effects the opponents are going to argue when they go to court to object to it? So, Your Honors, I would summarize, my time is almost up, by taking the position and arguing that under the proper legal analysis, if the court walks through the proper legal analysis on the single subject rule and identifies one, the purpose of the petition, and then two, applies the language of 295.009, which specifically says that it is one subject, if the parts of the proposed initiative referendum are functionally related and germane to each other in a way that provides sufficient notice of the general subject of and the interest likely to be affected, the provision. It's clear that this initiative petition satisfies those requirements. The broadness argument, while we agree that the immigration laws of the United States are a broad subject, there is nothing in the Nevada Constitution, there is nothing in Nevada statutes, and there's nothing in this case law interpreting the Constitution and Nevada statutes that prohibits the proponents of initiative petition to exercise the public's constitutional right to amend their constitution on a broad subject, so long as it is a single subject, as defined by NRS 295.09, it satisfies that requirement. With respect to the description of effect, this court is well aware of this jurisprudence primarily coming from the education initiative and all the language about no hypotheticals, no hypertechnical readings, all of those issues. It doesn't have to be the best description, it just has to be an accurate description. That the description of effect in this case is...
Finish your thought.
...is succinct, direct, accurate, non-deceptive, and non-misleading.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Elias and I am counsel to the appellees in this case. Since 1912, the Nevada Constitution has guaranteed the voters of the state the power to propose by initiative changes to the state constitution. It also, however, though, granted the legislature broad powers to facilitate that initiative process. And the legislature has chosen to institute two important safeguards to protect the electorate. Number one, it requires a single subject rule that every petition, every initiative petition, only has one subject. The second is that it requires the submission of a description of effects that gives the voters, or in this case the signers, a real sense, a practical sense of what the petition that they're being asked to put their signature to will achieve. Both of these two safeguards are in place for the same reason. They are to prevent voter confusion, and they are to promote informed decision-making. What appellants in this case are advocating is the functional undoing of those safeguards. By proposing an initiative that does not cover one topic or one subject, but rather a body of ever-changing federal law that is spread out among multiple sections of the United States Code, tens of thousands of pages of administrative regulations, hundreds and hundreds of court decisions, topics as different as criminal law to asylum, federal assistance programs to identification documents, employment authorization to biometric information storage, right to counsel to medical examinations. They are not in one discrete section of the United States Code. They are in Title VI. They are in Title VIII. They are in Title 18. They are in Title 22. They are in Title 29. They are in Title 42. It is simply an error to state that federal immigration law itself is a single subject. Federal immigration law assures certain immigrants of Social Security benefits. In other cases, it deals with how welfare is administered.
So could any initiative petition survive amending the Constitution as far as immigration is concerned in this state?
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor, because the genesis, I believe, of this very broad multi-subject initiative was actually a Senate bill introduced by Mr. Robeson that said, in relevant part, the governing body of a city shall not enact an ordinance or otherwise adopt, enforce, or endorse a policy which violates the provisions of 8 U.S.C. 1373. That's one specific provision of the immigration laws, which is what I assume, and I don't know, it is speculating, but I assume that that is actually the provision that this entirely broad initiative is aimed at getting at. But rather than simply saying, look, we want to put in the U.S. Constitution that the state governments have to help the federal government enforce the immigration laws as it relates to undocumented immigrants. Rather than putting that on the ballot, and presumably it would be very difficult to gather signatures if they tried to put that on the ballot, they said, let's take this to such a general level of abstraction to cover virtually everything that the federal government does. I mean, if you think about it, virtually everything the federal government does, it does in the immigration laws, right? Everything that you could imagine it regulates with respect to the welfare and policing power domestically or the treaty power abroad, for the nation as a whole, it deals with in duplicate and sometimes in triplicate in the context of federal immigration law. So it is simply incorrect to say that what is at issue here is a single subject. The district court correctly found that the petition violated the single subject rule because it is excessively broad in general and indeed embraces a multitude of subjects. And most importantly, the trial court found that as a result of that, it misleads the voters. And fundamentally, at its heart, the purpose of these laws, the purpose of the single subject rule, the purpose of the description of effects requirement, is to have an informed electorate.
Could you be specific on the misleading?
Tell
us exactly how it misleads the voters.
It misleads the voters in a number of respects. Let's start with the experience that the voter will have, or in this case, the signer, the voter who is being asked to sign. They are approached and they say, would you like to sign a petition to prevent sanctuary cities? Okay, let's assume I live in a rural part of Nevada. And I don't much care for cities. So I say, sure, doesn't affect me. Right? I don't live in a city. So it's not gonna affect my ranch. It's not gonna affect the workers on my ranch. It's not gonna affect the folks I see in my town. Because this is about preventing sanctuary cities. The misleading nature of this initiative begins with a title that seems to cabinet to the cities, when in fact the language itself does not cabinet such things. It does not simply affect Las Vegas, it doesn't simply affect Carson City, it doesn't simply affect Reno, it affects the entire state. The second way in which it is misleading is that the term sanctuary cities can connote it among some that there is lawlessness, that there is somehow currently obstruction going on by state and local government of the federal immigration law, and that needs remedying. Well, we just heard from my colleague that, in fact, there are no sanctuary cities in the state of Nevada. So that's the second way it misleads. The third is that for some voters, sanctuary cities connotes the notion of a sanctuary, that it actually is a good thing, that we're actually providing a safe place, a place that is safe from crime. And those voters are going to be confused because they're going to think, well, why are we trying to prevent sanctuary cities? I mean, after all, sanctuary sounds like a good thing. So it is confusing just in the title before you get to the subject matter. Now, with respect to the subject matter, Your Honor, one of the things that this court has been very diligent in policing is the notion of log rolling. That what we're going to do is we're going to take one piece of a initiative that is quite popular, and we're going to attach to it a whole bunch of other things that are less popular and are going to escape the view of the voter or the signer in this case. As I just mentioned, the person who has some notion of what immigration was and has a positive or a negative connotation as to that notion is not aware that what they are actually doing is not simply requiring the state government to cooperate with the federal government on that one issue, but on a broad range of issues involving ranging from treaties to biometric storage to Social Security benefits to welfare benefits. And so it is the ultimate in Lockwell. It is hidden, the logs are hidden. The voter doesn't even know what the logs are that are being rolled. All it knows is that there is this undefined notion of federal immigration law, which, as I point out, is ever-changing. I mean, as you know, Washington, D.C. is constantly talking about amending and changing to federal immigration law. So it's not even entirely clear, if you're the voter being asked to sign something, what iteration of immigration laws you believe are being discussed. And it's notable that the petition is as short as it is, because as counsel points out, most of the initiative petitions in this state are actually quite a bit longer. And I think it's instructive to the court as it decides this question of single subject. Why isn't there a definition section? Why isn't there something that would give fair notice to the person on the street who's being stopped at a grocery store and asked to sign something? Why isn't there something that spells out what federal immigration law is? I'm not raising a constitutional objection, and I'm not raising an overbreath 14th Amendment objection. I'm raising an objection under the statutes, which, as this court has repeatedly says, are intended to promote informed decision-making and to prevent voter confusion. And this initiative language does nothing to achieve.
Let me ask you this, and I hate to interrupt you. When could there ever be an initiative that, assuming you determine what the purpose of this is and the effect it might have, could there ever be an initiative that would suit their purposes?
Suit their purposes?
Yes.
Again, I might disagree with it as a matter of policy, but that's not what's before this court. But I think had they brought forth an initiative that simply spelled out the provision of federal immigration law.
But you just said it's so broad and it encompasses so much. How could they ever do that?
Because, Your Honor, I have little doubt that they are not actually seeking to require the city of Henderson to cooperate with the federal government in the enforcement of treaty obligations with you know, the Marianas Islands. Okay. I'm pretty sure that if they had wanted to, they would have, as the bill that sparked this did, could have singled out the exact provision, the one provision among the tens of thousands of provisions that, in fact, has motivated this legislation and, indeed, has motivated similar efforts around the country. It is a specific provision that deals with the relationship in the policing and ICE relationship over undocumented individuals. Turning to the description of effects, in addition to creating what would be a loophole on the single
that we're dealing here with the constitutional right of people to propose amendments to the Nevada Constitution, and constitutions speak in broadly general terms. They are not elaborate tax codes and the like. So the analysis you've spent the first part of your argument on this one, how would, say, for example, the First Amendment fare, which says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, how would that fare in the analysis you just deployed on this? We have a strong, our case law is really strongly supportive of the public's right to put things on the ballot. Good, bad policy, it's not for us to say. So I'm concerned about the level, the granular analysis you want to apply here.
Justice Pickering, I think that's a really important point. And it actually, I think, goes to the heart of my objection, or my client's objection here, which is that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. had at the time of the enactment of the First Amendment, and certainly today, a common understanding. It changes as courts, as technologies change and as courts rule in cases, there are iterations or shifts here and there, but there was a fundamental notion in English common law as to what was meant by freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And in fact, many of the originalists on the U.S. Supreme Court have written eloquently about that common law understanding as to what those terms meant at the time of the passage of the First Amendment. What's quite different here is that it's tied to a statutory code and a regulatory regime that is, in fact, there for which there is, in fact, no common understanding. In fact, it's not the immigration laws in 1924 look different than the immigration laws in 1954, and different still than 1984 and 2004. So unlike freedom of the press and freedom of speech, where there would be a shared understanding about what that means, a voter could understand what freedom of the press or have some sense of what freedom of the press and freedom of speech means. The federal code dealing with immigration is ever shifting. Indeed, as we stand here today, it may be being amended on the floor of the House of the Senate today. So it's quite unusual, and I don't want to say unprecedented because I can't support that, but I'm unaware of any constitution anywhere in any state that hinges on the statutory code.
Well, we have the minimum wage amendment, for example, in our constitution that picks up some of the federal tax, ERISA insurance issues, and incorporates those. I mean, it's an odd mix here that's going on.
Right, but here, again, it doesn't hinge on a particular part of the federal law. It is a subject of federal law that is actually not even contained by federal law purposes in one place.
It is a subject.
It is not a single subject. It is an umbrella of a multitude of subjects.
Okay.
What's wrong with that? Without commenting on the merits of this proposal, why can't a proponent say that our state, our cities and counties, should not be enacting laws that interfere with the federal immigration laws? Now, it may very well be that over time, courts have to interpret what's inclusive or not inclusive of immigration, the word immigration, just as courts have, over time, determined what is free speech and what isn't free speech. But nevertheless, in a constitutional context, a broad description, in this case, they didn't pick and choose which immigration laws, they said all immigration laws. So if the federal government enacts an immigration law tomorrow, or if there's one on the books today, this initiative prohibits state interference with that immigration law. How's that a violation of the rules we've enacted? Let's get focused here. The rules we've enacted for determining the single subject rule. My understanding from the briefs is that the single subject that's been articulated, again, not speaking to the policy, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent policy, is a separate question. But the single subject that's stated here seems pretty clear. Local government, state government, isn't going to adopt any law that interferes with federal immigration laws.
Your Honor,
sounds like a single subject to me.
Justice Hardesty, I think that is, under that rationale, the initiative could have said, the legislature shall not enact a law or otherwise adopted force or endorse a policy which prohibits, limits, or discourages cooperation with the enforcement of the laws of the United States. I mean, after all, the laws of the United States is every bit as much of a subject as the immigration laws.
True, but for purposes of the definition of single subject,
right,
embodied in our jurisprudence, Mr. Georgeson has argued that we look at, is it a single subject and are the matters that are contained in the language germane And in this instance, they said, don't interfere with the federal immigration laws. Sounds like a single subject, doesn't it? So where in our jurisprudence do you find, and I want you to rebut Mr. Chuck Jorgensen's argument. He says that the district court went off on a different rule than we've enacted for evaluating single subjects. And it has adopted a rule that says that if the word, in this case immigration, is too broad, that violates the single subject rule. We haven't said that in our jurisprudence.
Your Honor, I think that Las Vegas taxpayer accountability is as close as this court has come to that. And I understand every case is different. But I think that that is the closest where the court said that an excessively general subject can cause it to be a violate the single subject rule. And here's why that is how the court should develop the jurisprudence. Because immigration law itself covers ICE and Social Security. So they're not the same subject. Just because they are within a colloquialism, in fact, they're not even in the same title of the same code, they're just a colloquialism of immigration law. And that's why it violates the single subject rule. If I can turn to the statement of...
Mr. Elias, can I ask you one question on single subject, yes, quick? And I've used this example in other single subject, and we've had a bunch of them, so we're real familiar with all these arguments. We've heard them many times. My hypothetical is this, and I'm thinking about how broad you say the term immigration laws is. What if we had an initiative that's called criminal sentencing? It has two provisions. Number one, it doubles the penalties, the prison sentence for sexual assault upon minors. Number two, it abolishes the death penalty. And it's written in there, it's criminal sentencing, that's the subject of it, but it might be a log rolling thing for opponents of the death penalty to try and get it through as bait to get people to vote for it. Is that a violation of the single subject? Does that fit into the same analysis that you've made here?
So let me start by saying that I think that it would be a much closer question because they both involve criminal sentencing.
Okay.
And here, the notion of immigration laws actually don't all even have to do with immigration. Okay. They have to do with treaty obligations or data storage or other things. So I think it would be a closer question in a different case. I think that there would be a good argument that it would violate the single subject for precisely the reason you said, which is that you are essentially attaching and log rolling a anti-death penalty with an increased sentence. Okay. If I could turn to the description of effects requirement. The description of effects is required, again, to promote informed decision making. And I want to take a step back and go to the early cases where this court dealt with the question of whether or not this description of effects were constitutional. And you applied the Anderson verdict test to say that it was. That requiring a description of effects did not offend the U.S. Constitution. But you recognize that under certain circumstances it might, because you're limited to 200 words. So when you now fast forward out of the constitutional cases and into the statutory cases, most of the cases where we are arguing about description of effects, we are arguing about a long initiative that has to be described in 200 words. So the court's jurisprudence has developed largely against the fact that there probably would be a constitutional violation under the Anderson-Burdick federal constitutional test if you couldn't describe the effects in 200 words. So this court has had to develop a jurisprudence that allows long initiatives to be described, the effects described in 200 words. Here, the description of effects is 71 words. Okay, they didn't use 40% of the words. They didn't use 60% of the words that they had available. So this is not the usual case that presents before this court, where they are trying to figure out how in 200 words to describe something very long. In fact, they created a description of effects that is, in fact, leaves them more than half of the words available to use. And what they did is they simply didn't describe any effect.
So what you're saying in a nutshell is by omission they've created something that's confusing and misleading.
Correct, Your Honor. By omission they've created something confusing and misleading, and Nevada, unlike many other states, including, for example, Arizona. Arizona's got an interesting statute. Arizona simply requires, or not simply, it requires that where there is an initiative, you have to summarize the initiative. And that's what you do. So at the top of the petition, it's a summary of the initiative. Nevada doesn't say summarize the initiative. It says to describe the effects. And with all due respect to able counsel, the appellants didn't really try. I mean, they didn't try to describe any effects. The effect that they seem to say that they described is that it will amend the Constitution.
Well, but it will amend the Constitution to prohibit state, local, county governments from enacting laws that interfere with federal immigration.
But that's not the effect.
But I mean, the effect is on, it's an immediate effect. The primary effect is on the local governments and the state legislature. It's a prohibition against them enacting laws. Right now, they're free to do whatever they want. This would inhibit that freedom. So it has that effect. Well, now, collateral effect, additional effects are what you're getting at, and I understand that. But it does describe the immediate effect, which is it's going to inhibit currently uninhibited lawmaking abilities by our various local and state governments.
So Justice Pickering, I'm glad you mentioned that, because in fact, one of the effects that we point to that should have been described and which counsel did not focus on, so I want to focus the court's attention on, is Nevada is by constitution a bill and rule state. It's a bill and rule state that's modified in that it allows, the constitution allows the legislature to provide home rule of sorts to counties and cities with some limitations on taxes and some other business regulation. And the legislature in 2015 actually passed a sweeping home rule statute that in fact changed the nature of the state from a straight Gillen rule state to really a home rule state that is really, it's called a modified Dillon's rule state because that's how the state constitution is drafted, but it functions as predominantly a home rule state except on the issue of taxes and business regulation. So at a minimum, the statement of effects should have indicated that the cities and counties are losing home rule authority as it affects these topics. That would seem to me to be a pretty important effect. I did a Google search. It seemed that in 2015, this was a hotly debated issue. This was a topic that the public was quite attentive to. They were aware of the issue of home rule. It was not slipped into the law in the middle of the night. There were strongly held views on both sides. And if this initiative is going to undo home rule in the area of public safety and public health, safety, and welfare, as it conflicts with any aspect does not promote any aspect of federal immigration law, that would seem like not a hypothetical effect. That's a pretty concrete effect.
Let me ask you this. If the object of the description of effect is when the petition is being circulated to people and they're being asked to sign it so that it goes on the ballot, right?
Yes, sir.
And so it's a fundamental quick understanding of what this is designed to do, right?
Yes, sir.
And then when it goes on the ballot, there are much more elaborate or pro and con statements that go with the actual initiative that's submitted to the voters, correct?
Yes, sir.
So within this 200 words, it's problematic to me to how you apply that test of what it is you're trying to ensure is adequately conveyed to someone who needs information about whether to sign or not sign to have something go on the ballot. It's not a substantive evaluation of the merits of the proposal. It's whether or not it should be on the ballot.
I completely agree, Justice Pickering, and that's why I started where I did by noting that they only use 71 of the 200 words. So I have sympathy in certain circumstances.
I mean, brevity is, in my book, is not a problem normally, but
it is when the voters are confused by it.
Yes, fair enough.
And again, remember, Your Honor, Nevada could have said, just provide a summary. That's what Arizona did.
Most obvious confusion here, the argument you began with, the description of effects should tell the voters that this prohibition implicates vast provisions of the federal code on every subject from asylum to you name it.
Yes, Your Honor. So
one description of effect might be immigration is not defined, so it is unclear what we're talking about when we're talking about immigration.
That would indeed be one way that it could have been, that it could have, or it at a minimum should have been.
So let me ask you this. In description of effect cases, we have remanded to the district court to review the description of effect when there has been a problem. Should this case be remanded?
Your Honor, we have no objection to, if this court believes that it is a fixable description of effects and remand is appropriate, then that's fine with us. I want to point out one other effect, if I may, Justice Scalia, do you have a question? I didn't want to not address all of your questions.
It's your time. I don't want to cut you off.
One of the other effects that I think is particularly important to the people of Clark County is that there is a 287G agreement in the detention center that, as you know, under federal law and state law is voluntary. They could enter into it, they could drop out of it. This language would create a one-way ration where they would no longer be able to drop out of it because it would be, they would be enacting an ordinance.
Finish your statement.
Enacting an ordinance or otherwise adopting or endorsing a policy which discourages cooperation. And that notion of discouraging cooperation means that effectively we create a one-way ratchet for counties. They can only go in one direction because if they ever want to shift in the other direction because of budget concerns, because of resource concerns, because of public policy concerns, they're not able to do that. So I think that's another description of effect that would be appropriate to be included. Thank you.
Now, Justice Stevens, did you have a question you wish to ask?
That was my question.
And Justice Cherry, I know you tried to ask.
I tried to ask a question about whether 129 more words would make a difference to your clients. Another 100. Even if Scalia was alive and he said, Justice Scalia, give us 129 more words to survive sustainability of this effect. And even if we remand it, what about the single subject rule? I mean, you'd still have that issue.
I think that to be clear, I didn't say a remand is preferable or appropriate. Certainly on the single subject rule, it would not be. If this court believes that the description of effects, however, is curable, you know, I'm not optimistic that on remand it is curable, but I never tell a Supreme Court that it can't remand to a lower court.
Gee, I wonder if we'll hear the word concede during our conference.
may I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm sorry. So just to be clear, one effect, the last one that you touched upon, for instance, with civil immigration detainers, would this convert otherwise permissible discretion on behalf of the local governments into a mandatory? So where the federal government has carved out locals have discretion to look at these voluntary agreements or to basically volunteer to cooperate, would that take away the local discretion from our jurisdictions to decide whether or not they want to cooperate in where the federal government has permitted them to do so?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I mean about it being a one-way ratchet. It's simply, it locks counties in only ever getting more and more cooperative with the federal government because of that word discourage. So it can't take any, it can't even echo a sentiment, a statement, a sense of the legislature, a sense of the city to not. So it creates that one-way ratchet. Yes, Your Honor.
And these are in areas where the federal government has permitted the discretion of local authorities?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Justice Hardesty?
Yeah. So if the federal government were at some point to enact a sweeping immigration law change, and that law deferred to the state's immigration decisions, the enactment of this provision under this interpretation would preclude this state from exercising authority that had been given to it by the federal government.
That's correct.
Any others? Hearing none, thank you. The court thanks both counsel for their arguments this day, the thoroughness and explanatory nature of what was offered, and the professionalism shown in making those arguments. This matter will stand submitted.